Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Quentin Hardy, Deputy Technology Editor for the New York Times, based in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm your moderator for this afternoon's program. Today's meeting takes us to a close-up look at innovation and entrepreneurship around the world. Here in Silicon Valley, we're near hotbeds of all kinds of businesses, but make no mistake, hunger and the creativity to make things new, to make businesses, to make a better life for ourselves is everywhere around the world, and it's increasing. As costs come down and as information and opportunities increase, thanks to a global technology and information revolution. As we will discover today, it is aided in part by some forward-looking programs by U.S. institutions, both private and public. I'm pleased to introduce Kathleen Campbell, President and Chief Executive Officer of CRDF Global, an independent nonprofit organization promoting international scientific and technical collaboration through grants, technical resources, training, and services. Campbell has 3 decades of international science and technology policy and program management experience from her work at the Department of Commerce, the White House Office of Science and Technology, and the U.S. State Department. Under Ms. Campbell's leadership, CRDF Global has conducted the search for high-tech talent throughout the world through the GIST Award, the Global Innovation Through Science and Technology Competition. They've found some wonderful young people doing fascinating programs, and we'll hear a bit about those today. Also joining us is Dr. Jonathan Margulies, Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary for Science, Space, and Health in the U.S. Department of State. Dr. Margulies is a career diplomat working on many environmental, technical, and scientific initiatives, including overseeing the GIST Awards, which are actually funded by the U.S. Department of State. These awards are designed to build a culture of entrepreneurial enterprise in 43 countries across the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. GIST's mission is to encourage innovators in these regions through global networking, entrepreneurship skill building, mentorship, and strategic funding of the most promising projects. Dr. Margulies is responsible for policies and programs in these areas of international science and technology cooperation, space and advanced technologies, and international health and biodefense. And now, we are delighted to introduce our panel of young innovators called the Transformers, who are visiting America from around the world. They are 4 of this year's 17 winners of the GIST Award. Proceeding from my near left, Mustafa Kane, the founder of Amarate, a technology, communications, and mobile tech platform based in the West African city of Dakar in Senegal. From Algeria, the city of Algiers, Miriam Shiri, the co-founder of SmellNet, an environmentally friendly company that extracts essential oils from plants for use in the health and cosmetics industries. Continuing down, Dr. Khairul Bahrain, the CEO of MyDerm, an innovative company that develops products for the medical field, in particular new skin for burn victims based in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And lastly, Hassanul Mirza, Director of Operations at Greenovation Technologies, a sustainable and affordable housing construction company based in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Welcome all of you to California. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Okay, well, Kathy, I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about the program so we can locate, you know, what you're doing and who some of these young entrepreneurs are. So please explain a little bit about CDRF, what the competition's about, how tough the competition was, and what kind of submissions you get every year.
Thanks, Quentin. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk to you a little bit about CRDF Global. Our mission and our work is to execute programs that enable scientists and innovators around the world to develop technology solutions to current economic and development challenges. We work in over 50 countries, and we partner quite a bit with other organizations, other nonprofits, academia, businesses, and governments in order to have maximum impact in the programs that we launch. One of our most active programs right now is the Global Innovation Through Science and Technology Program, the GIST program. And as you heard earlier, the goal is to develop and nurture and build entrepreneurship ecosystems abroad. We've been very busy with the GIST program this last year. We have had 2 business plan competitions as well as 4 startup boot camps. Through the first competition that we called the Technology Idea Competition, we invited applicants to submit 2-minute video business pitches on YouTube, and then the top vote getters on Facebook, the ones with the highest number of likes on Facebook, were invited to come to Turkey, where we did a couple days of mentorship and business plan pitches, which they made to a panel of judges, and awards were given to the top entrepreneurs.
That's astonishing. How long have you been with this program?
Just?
Yes.
We've been doing this for year and a half.
Okay. It's astonishing to me that the application is a 2-minute video on YouTube now.
Yes.
Everybody
yes.
knows what that means. Yes. Everybody posed to it 5 years ago. That would have been unthinkable. It's
absolutely. Absolutely.
But sorry, go ahead.
So our second competition was a more traditional format. We called it the iDARE Business Plan Competition, which we did in partnership with the MIT Enterprise Forum. And this was a standard submission of business plans. When those applications went through 2 reviews by experts, and then the same process, if we narrowed down the list to the top candidates, brought them for mentorship and more work with coaches, and then they made their pitches before panels of judges, and the top vote-getters received awards. And then in addition to that, we did the 4 startup boot camps in Algeria, Senegal, Indonesia, and Malaysia. And again, same situation where the entrepreneurs were invited to give pitches before a panel of local and international judges. And again, awards were given to the top vote getters. And it's from that pool of entrepreneurs that we selected the 17 GIST Transformers that we have brought to the United States for this journey. And it was a tough competition. We received over 8,000 applications, and so the 17 GIST Transformers are really the best of the best through this process. And this journey is all about continuing to provide learning opportunities for them. They're getting additional mentoring. They're visiting with U.S. entrepreneurs and learning from their experiences. They're sharing individual experiences with each other, with business leaders, with potential investors. So we're really excited about the opportunity and the learning that obviously is going on already for these entrepreneurs.
Okay, and Dr. Margolis, I did have a question for you before we turn it over to our winners. Why is it important for the U.S. government to be funding competitions like this? Why should I feel good about my tax dollars going to 8,000 talented, contestants?
Yeah, and Quentin, thank you very much for the question. You really put your finger on it. I think folks know that President Obama has made a priority for first term and now second term, obviously, science, technology, and innovation. He's talked about how central that is to the U.S. economy. I can tell you from personal experience at the State Department that many other countries around the world now see science, technology, innovation as we do, namely that it is the way that they will promote economic growth in their countries. And in the State Department, we look at science diplomacy as a way of moving things forward, science diplomacy where we use science to achieve foreign policy objectives, and we use foreign policy to achieve science objectives. And typically, when you work in the State Department, those activities tend to be government to government. The nice thing about this program, GIST, is that what we're working on here is more of a people-to-people operation, where the entrepreneurs themselves are the ones who are actually going to be the, if you will, almost agents of change, working in their own countries to promote ideas of entrepreneurship and innovation ecosystem that maybe we take for granted here in the United States, but where if we can build that system in other countries and through these incredibly talented people, inspire them, give them the confidence to take those steps that here in Silicon Valley people think about every day, but we're in other parts of the world where they may not be having as much of the opportunity, well, then we're hoping that we can help transform such other societies and give them the opportunities that we take for granted maybe here in the United States or that we have come to relish here in the United States.
So the goal is to be so successful that Silicon Valley has competition elsewhere?
I think the way I would think about it is that from our perspective, if we can replicate the kinds of systems we have here in the United States, American businesses will do just fine.
Right. Another way to sharpen that, obviously, flip question is that competition lights up our competition. They buy our products is the principle. And people who are in business tend not to go to war.
Absolutely true. And additionally, as we've seen throughout many parts of the world nowadays, societies face all kinds of challenges economically. If they can't provide for their citizens, those societies become somewhat less stable. So the degree that we can help export these ideas, these innovators, and the desire to make change, I think we're doing well for the American people.
Well, this is great. So let's turn it over to our entrepreneurs now. And I want to talk about that a little bit because in some ways, some of you are touching on local markets in very important ways, and some of you are thinking about international markets. But, I'll start with you, Mustafa. Why don't you each talk a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself, talk about your company, and say what it means to be an entrepreneur in your country.
Okay. So thank you, Kantin. Thank you for giving us the opportunity of being in front of such an audience and to tell a bit more about our country, about what we're doing. So thank you for CRDF giving us this opportunity as well. To let you know about myself, I'm an entrepreneur in Senegal. Senegal is a French-speaking country in West Africa, and I've done my master's degree in France. And I went back home in 2002 to set up a web and mobile company working on web technologies. Being an entrepreneur in Senegal is just like the same basis as being an entrepreneur here in the United States on Silicon Valley. The people we met already, we share the same spirit of doing something. But what's really different is the tools we're using. We are in a market that we don't have the opportunities of having big venture capitalists. We don't have all the opportunity of raising money very easily. But when you don't have that, you should be more clever, I should say, in order to survive. Okay, so we can talk more about it. I can let you know a lot about our day-to-day business and day-to-day struggling. But we feel very, very happy to be here. And being an entrepreneur is something very different from being an entrepreneur in the United States in the point of view also of the picture you have in front of people. When you get your university degree and when you decide to be an entrepreneur, you look sometimes very strange, because they want you to carry on your work in a big company and then to go in that way. When you decide to stop all this and say, okay, I'll be starting a startup with two people and a few computers are not working very well, they just say, okay, Mustafa is not going very...
well, you are groomed to be an engineer and to kind of, bring in a good wage and provide for people and be part of a larger organization, particularly in telecommunications. But you chose not to take that route, and instead, Amarante, talk a little bit about the idea and what you're doing for people through this method.
Okay. So, yes, we decided this. It was really an idea that wanted to catch. Amarante is working on what we call airtime. It's the electronic credit voucher. Telecommunication in Senegal is a bit different from telecom operators here. A big part of our market, more than 80%, is based on what we call prepaid credit. Prepaid credit means that before you give a phone call, you have to pay your airtime. And this is can be a little bit strange here, but we are carrying cash to buy airtime credit in order to make phone call. And the application we developed allowed people to share this electronic credit between them. Because airtime credit for us is not only calling, is sort of money, because we are using it to give a gift to someone. We are using it to reimburse a money that we borrow. We are using it really as electronic money.
Time is money.
Yeah.
Literally, the minutes are money.
Exactly. Giving the opportunity to someone to share it between two telecom operators is the kind of huge innovation, especially when you know that the regulation there don't allow people to have one phone number and to use it with two or three telecom operators. This is very specific to our economic reality.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Miriam, let's Shire. Let's talk about Smellnet a little bit and how you became involved in being an entrepreneur in Algeria.
Okay, hello everybody. I'm very happy to be here, and I want to thank you for inviting us. So I'm actually an electrical engineer. Maybe it's so far from our project, because it's an extraction essential oils unit. Last year, I had the opportunity to get a special program in my institute. It was an entrepreneurship program. It's first time in Algeria. So we take this program. And this program, we had to work in groups on an entrepreneurship project. So in the beginning, it was only a university program. But after taking part in many competitions and taking part in the meeting investors who are very interested by our project, we transform it into a business project. So Smellnet is an extraction essential oils in an environmentally friendly way to extract these essential oils from the plants.
So you take the essential oils from locally grown in an environmentally friendly way. I should say, we were talking a little bit beforehand, and as you say, you're an electrical engineer, so you use solar panels to power the extraction of the essential oils. What are some of the popular products you're looking at creating?
So in our process, we integrate the photovoltaic panels, so the solar panels, and the biomass energy.
Right.
Yeah, and we try to be economic. So our process is we integrate all the waste in order to be economic and to protect essential oils and bio antioxidants.
Essential oils from which plants?
From basil, sage, mint, eucalyptus.
Basil, sage, mint, eucalyptus.
And rosemary.
Are they sold in the Algerian market, or do you hope to export?
Actually, in the beginning, we'll focus on the Algerian market, because our demand of essential oils is very big. So we'll focus on the Algerian market. After that, we will try to sell our products in the European market, because it's a huge market.
And since you have the microphone right now, I want to ask you our first question from the audience. How common is it for women inventors to be groomed to become entrepreneurs in Algeria?
It's a bit difficult, yes, I agree. But I'm lucky, because my father is a transformer, he's an entrepreneur, so
What business was your father in?
Electrical.
Oh, okay.
Electrical industry. Yeah, so we received big encouragement from him, and even from our teacher institute. Our professors were very helpful and encouraged that a lot.
Okay, well, thank you. And now we'll turn it to Khairul Baharin, the CEO of MyDerm. And this is a story of people walking away from good careers to start businesses. You were a medical doctor, and you've decided to grow skin instead.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that, please.
First of all, thank you, everyone, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a medical doctor, and I'm building a company called Cell Tissue Technology currently. What we are focusing on is advanced medical technology. When we're talking about that, we are thinking of to change the whole landscape of medicine. Maybe in the future, yes. Before this, we have cloning, we have genetic engineering, and now we have tissue engineering. So what we try to do is, as a medical doctor, from our day-to-day activity in operation theater, especially dealing with skin trauma and injuries, we thought, oh, it's very hard with the current conventional treatment that we have. We have to get some skin from other sorts. For example, cadaver or animals. And always the case is it's not fully accepted by the body. There'll be rejection and infection going on after that. And doctors have to treat the complications over and over again. So we thought, okay, would it be possible for us to just create a skin and patch it up on that? Mm-hmm. So that's why the idea came about, and 10 years before this, our professors have done their R&D in the university. So we came up with a technology where we can culture cells that extracted from the patient itself, mm-hmm. Bring to our cGMP certified laboratory, and we culture it, and there goes, we have a skin. So in a way, we can call it, we are actually producing an artificial skin, especially for medical treatments, for patients with burns or wounds or practically chronic ulcers, comes from diabetes and all that. So we are actually planning to be a hub of skin maybe some 2 to 3 years later in Malaysia first.
Now, Dr. Margulies, Ms. Campbell, how much money did you give Dr. Baharin? Is it a substantial? The reason I ask is I hear about that, and typically if you were in the Silicon Valley, this would be $50 million, you know, in 10 years to grow this kind of a business.
Now, we're talking about much, much smaller yeah. Amounts of money, as in, you know, 10,000 or less.
And that's an important amount for you to make a business like that. You can do this for that?
Of course, of course, especially now that we are at a startup stage. We'll take anything that we got.
Yeah, I'm with that.
That's number one.
Right.
But the more important reason that we join the whole GIST journey is actually for the experience and the exposure of it that we could never get if we just go alone by
right.
ourselves.
Right.
Back at home, yes, I do agree. We have full support from our government. So it's a very expensive technology to start with. Our government gives full support, and they funded almost 90% of it. So we are very thankful. So in terms of the commercialization alone, that's the only part that we go startup, as we know today, lean startup way. Yeah. So that's how we go small with it.
And let me ask you the same question that I asked of Miriam. Do you see this for the domestic market, or do you see this as an international market?
At first we thought, okay, this may be a domestic market, but later we find out that, yeah, upon traveling here and there, especially with GIS, we find out it's actually a common thing that everywhere the doctors are facing and also the patients are facing. I think this is going to be, if ever it's going to take off, this is going to be a huge next big thing in the future of medicine. So I'm excited for
it. And you were saying it won't just, like any good entrepreneur, while you're building this, you're thinking about what's next and
exactly.
How can I make my empire? So this doesn't end with skin, right?
No, it's not actually so much about that. Yes, of course. But it's more of, okay, if I'm being a doctor, I can treat a patient one-on-one. But this way, I can treat my patients a whole lot more at another level. So I think it's just about the right thing to do for me.
It's about changing medicine.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Like the vision. Okay, and so hitting cleanup. Hassanul Mirza, Director of Operations at Greenovation Technologies, Sustainable and Affordable Housing Construction in Bangladesh. Why don't you talk a little bit about what that means, how you came to it, and what it means to be an entrepreneur in that kind of a market, which we don't associate with high tech.
Okay. Thank you for giving me the floor, and I would like to thank CRDF Global and GIST, and especially the Commonwealth Club for having us here today. I am Hassanul Kader Mirza from Bangladesh, and I'm Director of Operations at Greenovation Technologies Private Limited. So this is an organization which introduces a low-cost and sustainable housing material for the marginalized poor people of our country. And why this is sustainable and also low-cost? So basically the raw materials that we are using to produce this housing material is jute fiber and polymer resin. So the innovation in this is that the jute and resin does not go together. So they don't usually bond. So actually this is the innovation that we have been successful in bonding them and make it a lot more stronger than the existing alternatives that are available in our country.
Now our audience might know jute better as the core material that went into making burlap bags
for
many, many years. And, of course, you have a lot of competition now from mm-hmm. petrochemicals and plastics.
Right.
So is there this abundance of this material in Bangladesh still?
Yes, definitely. Jute, Bangladesh is one of the major jute producers in the world. And for your information, I'd like to add another thing. Like jute, in the research that we have found that jute is 22 times stronger than steel.
Really?
If we can use it properly, yes. Currently, it's 1.5 times stronger that we're using. So it can be like 22 times stronger.
And what is the competition in building materials you're up against? Are we talking about wood? Are we talking about plastics?
So
what are most homes made
back from? In Bangladesh, basically, we are a country of 164 million people, which is a very large population if we consider the area of our country. And out of these 164 million people, like 21 million people are literally homeless. So when we started this thing, we did not think about like going for technological product. Rather, we thought like we have to solve the problem of the basic needs of human. So that's why we addressed this one. Like when we came through the innovation, we took it to use and use it for the people.
Mm-hmm. So this is a quite an expensive material in that case. If you're
and
housing
about the competitors,
the 12% that are homeless in your country.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, the question again, please.
The material is relatively inexpensive.
Oh yeah, jute is really inexpensive in our country, and if we compare the competitors' product, like the corrugated iron sheets that people are using, and thatch and bamboos, like
mm-hmm.
thatch and bamboos are really inferior in quality, and the corrugated iron sheets that people use there are really expensive, and they use lead as a raw material, which is really harmful for the environment. So there are competitors, but still I think like for the poor people, this is 40% less costly than the existing alternatives, which can be really helpful for them.
You know, entrepreneurs out in the valley mm-hmm. historically love to talk about how cheaply they run their company or how price competitive
right.
they are. When you're competing with thatch, you know, you're really talking about running cheap. That's great.
Definitely.
That's fantastic. And I want to follow up with a question. I'm going to blend two questions from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just take jump ball. Please, whoever, you know, wants to answer this one. Talk a little bit about some of the unique characteristics of your country in terms of the culture and the business and the regulation that helps you developing in your company. And also some of the things that might stand in the way of developing your company, including access to capital or institutional bias against new companies starting up. What have you found so far?
Right, I'll start.
Sure,
go ahead.
Okay, so this is it's about for example, for Malaysia, back then in Malaysia. The ecosystem that we have, especially when it comes to new startups, I think it's almost similar to what we have here in the US, but it's just that maybe it's at smaller scale, one.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one, it's not totally supported by, I would say, academician at that time, because, It's not tally, I would say. Here comes the researchers, the professors are doing one thing, one research, one invention, but they don't really tag along with the industry, what the needs are and all that. So I think that's the gap, as opposed to what we have here in the US. I think from the journey that we went yesterday, before we even come up with invention, they sort of like go to the industry and see what's actually the needs.
Right.
So I think if ever there's something to be highlighted, I would highlight that. But in terms of the challenge that we have back then in Malaysia, the capital we get, it's not easily that we can find angels or VCs everywhere in Malaysia. But there are channels that if we know can really helpful and get us a long way. It's just about the matter of how we go out and represent ourselves and convince them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if If we're talking about Senegal in terms of entrepreneurship, there's a slightly different culture of entrepreneurship. Usually when people are starting businesses at home, no people with a university degree. They are very challenging entrepreneurship, but in the commerce and in little businesses. So they understand when you are talking about entrepreneurship, they understand that you're doing it in that level. Mm-hmm. But when it's coming to startup, to technology, it's a bit more difficult to get access to finance because the banking system is almost the one who have the finance and the money, and they don't really understand how ICT is going, how angel and venture capitalists are working. Mm-hmm. We have very little venture capitalists there, and they are investing in big project, governance projects especially,
mm-hmm.
because maybe it's that also the size of the market. If you take the Senegalese market only, it won't represent a big amount of money. But actually what we're doing, young entrepreneurs, is that we are seeing things like a global area. When you're talking business actually in Africa, you're talking about West Africa, Eastern Africa, and that makes sense, and that's starting to interest venture capitalists.
Oh, so it's becoming more broad across the region as people see opportunities.
Absolutely.
Some of the hazards and risks have died down, and some of the economies are growing. So there are opportunities in the capital markets?
Exactly. There are opportunities, and if you take an area like what we call UEMOA, which means all the country sharing the franc CFA money, that makes sense for finance, that makes sense for venture capitalists to come. They're starting to look at this market.
We should also say, why don't you talk about what an Amarante is, by the way. You've named your company Amarante. Why is that?
Okay. So Amarante is a bird. It's a bird that are located in Africa, are located in Europe. I don't know United States. I haven't seen it. But
no.
it's a bird that have good values, like the capability of living everywhere, is waking up very early. And that's talk to us in terms of entrepreneurship values.
So there you go. It speaks to the need. That's right. So did others want to talk about your... Miriam, you want to talk about...
For Algeria, like Khairul said, it's the same thing. There's no link between entrepreneurs and academicians. So we have entrepreneurs, but they are not graduated. They have not a diploma or engineer or something. Most of all, engineers in my country work for companies, for foreign companies, and working in trying to have to get your own business in Nigeria is a bit difficult because our company, our economy is based on petroleum and gas industry. So
big money,
getting
big
encouraged,
capital,
to be encouraged to build your own business, it's difficult.
Okay.
I would like to say about like two challenges in student entrepreneurship in our country. The first one would be raising capital for the company, and the second one would be the traditional culture back in our country. And by that I mean like your parents would not allow you to go for business. I mean, if you're saying them that I want to do a business, they will just look very surprised, like, oh my God, why would we do that?
What went wrong?
So, yeah, what went wrong?
What you're telling me is your parents don't actually know you're here?
No, this is the, regular scenario. I was very happy that my parents allowed me to do such. But the problem is that, the parents want a very safe and secure job for their children. So if you're just graduating from your business school or any other schools, like they would come up to you and say, now you should start looking for jobs.
Right.
So this is one of the things.
I think you bring up a very important difference because mm-hmm. one of the strengths of the Silicon Valley mm-hmm. compared to other parts of the United States, we like to think, is that this is an area where if you fail, that's okay. In fact, that's a good thing because that means you learned something. Failure is better learning than success is learning. But that doesn't even carry through in most of the United States. Do you have that kind of fear of failure? Is that what your parents were afraid of?
Yeah, definitely there is a fear of failure in the parents' mind, I guess.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to take chances with their children.
But let's spend a minute on the commonalities, because you're meeting entrepreneurs here mm-hmm. in the Valley, and you've been with each other for it must be at least 36 hours now. But you've met each other or people like yourselves from many countries in these competitions. Do you find things you have in common that surprised you?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean,
but go on.
Sure.
Yeah, take okay. turns. It's okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like,
so,
I mean, it's
like when you're entrepreneur or crazy, I think I'm happy to find entrepreneurs for whom the being entrepreneur is crazy in their countries. So. Mm-hmm.
And if we look at them and we are sharing the same thing, like we said in the beginning, people of the Silicon Valley running businesses, we share the same value, but we're doing it differently. We have different tools, but we are really sharing the same value. And I would like just to add something. When people don't want their son to become an entrepreneur in our country, it's just because entrepreneur didn't succeed a lot.
Right.
I mean, if you have to help your family, if you have to do something, and then 100 people doing entrepreneurs, there's no one getting success. So they succeed. That's why they don't want you to go through. So there is a big challenge for every one of us to make entrepreneurs succeed in what they are doing.
Right.
That's a bit what we are looking here also.
Okay. I'd like to remind our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guests are winners of the Global Innovation Through Science and Technology competition. Hassanul Kadir Mizra, Director of Operations at Greenovation Technologies in Bangladesh. Khairul Idzwan Baharin, CEO of MyDerm from Malaysia. Mustafa Khan, founder of Amarante in Senegal, West Africa. And Miriam Chiri, co-founder of Smelnat in Algeria of North Africa. Also joined with Kathy Campbell, president and CEO of the nonprofit CRDF Global, which oversaw the competition. And Dr. Jonathan Margulies, acting deputy assistant secretary of state for Science, Space, and Health in the U.S. State Department. And I'm Quentin Hardy, Deputy Technology Editor of the New York Times. I'm sorry, I interrupted someone else who wanted to talk about the entrepreneurial culture you're finding. You were the last one.
All right. I think we are very lucky back there in Malaysia because we don't quite have that much of... over there, parents are quite open.
Yeah,
they encourage, if not all of their children, at least one or two to become entrepreneur, because it's also part of the culture there that's been, been there for. I mean, they've been cherishing almost 10 years now. Innovation, technology, entrepreneurship, business—it's all there.
On the
everywhere.
Western side of Malaysia, the government has promoted both manufacturing and innovation in Penang and on the western coast, and you have Singapore to the south, which is a pretty big entrepreneurial culture
exactly.
as well.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of already built in us, and it's part of the culture and stuff, but it's just a matter of whether you are successful or not successful entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. So that's the most, highlighted
question. That's the challenge
question.
Anyway.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
Now, it's interesting. You all mentioned kind of cultural barriers and not regulatory barriers. You were able to penetrate, and the telecoms market in most countries used to be the most regulated thing around, but that's not an issue anymore?
Yes, it is. It's an issue. Maybe it's not the most important, but it's a very, very, very big issue. Because in telecom, actually, you have when you're talking about the regulation, you don't have the possibility of do all that you can do here in these developing countries. For example, actually, we in telecom markets in Senegal, operators are only working with their own consumers. The consumers, once you get your mobile phone, you don't have the opportunity of using the resources of the other telecom operators as you're doing here. Just to let you show you an example, when you have one phone number, I mean, there's no possibility of keeping your phone number with another telecom operator that you can quite easily hear.
So you come in between their businesses that way.
Exactly. So what we provide is we give people the possibility of having the advantage of using all the operators without the inconvenience.
So, Kathy, I want to ask you, we have here a biomedical firm, agriculture, high tech, telecom, and new materials corporations, nascent but potentially quite important businesses. What sort of things guide your choices? Is it around industries? Is it around the business's chance for success? What do you think the judges looked at the most?
In terms of the competitions that we launch, we generally do make them open to a wide range of technologies. And so we'll respond to whatever the applications are. The judges looked for qualities that you would expect in any kind of business plan competition. Is it a sound business proposition? What is the team that they've put together? Do they understand the market? How well do they present and deal with the questions from the judges? And is, you know, they, is there an opportunity for success for the company?
And we had a question from the audience in this regard. Is anything done for the other 7,983 out of 8,000 contestants so they might aspire to one day be among the 17 winners?
Yes, as we whittled down the number of applicants, we did try to provide training for as many people as possible. We couldn't reach all 8,000. But we are looking at other possibilities,
right,
to do online training, and et cetera, to reach out to.
And these two-minute pitches they put up,
yes,
on YouTube, can I find them on the Internet,
yes,
still? Oh, they're,
yes,
still up there.
Yes.
What would they be called? GIST competition?
Yes, yes, if you go to the GIST
you
website.
You just wasted hours of my valuable time. That's fantastic. And do you monitor follow-up to see how the people who won awards 10, 15 years ago are doing today?
Well, these kinds of – the GIST program is a relatively new program. In the other kinds of programs that CRDF Global has done, which have focused a little more on research, we do try to follow up with the researchers to find out how they've – how their careers have evolved and how the work has matured.
And let me just tweak the question a little bit for you, Dr. Margolis. You know, as state looks at this, do you hope to fund things that are impactful in technology, impactful in promoting capitalist endeavor? What is it that the impact you'd like to see from this?
Yeah, and so I'd like to say both, but for this particular program, I think the real goal here is more on the entrepreneurial spirit, the innovation side. Every one of the projects that you heard about has a science and technology component, and that's kind of the heart of the matter. But the ultimate goal is to promote more the if you will, the entrepreneurial infrastructure so that the individuals that we're talking about can move their companies forward. That said, there are a lot of programs that the State Department funds that have a different focus, more along the lines of scientific research, where our goal there is, as I think most of the audience probably knows, science is increasingly global. If researchers in the United States don't have access to the latest technologies, the latest infrastructure, the latest facilities, some of the best minds, they're not only located in the United States now. So to the degree that the State Department can help U.S. researchers be on the cutting edge of science by international collaboration, that's a goal where we put the science first as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things we've been talking about on the edges here is just how really sophisticated these winners are, and I'm sure many, many of the competitors, sophisticated in terms of their technology approach, their view of the market, their ability to really shake things up, potentially, in terms of the businesses they're creating. This isn't just sort of a distribution of other people's products or a cheaper manufacturer. This is reshaping, potentially, the way their own economies function to some extent, and, you know, delivering cheaper services or better housing, what have you. And to that end, I wanted to ask you all a little bit about how you became so knowledgeable and so sophisticated in countries that where information may not have been so readily available. Is this just, do you spend a lot of time on the Internet learning from other countries? Is there kind of a common sense in the world now about what an entrepreneur is and might do? Mustafa, could you speak about your own experience and how you, well, most basic question. When did you first get hooked onto the Internet?
Okay, wow. You know, the first one for me for Internet was in 1996, I think.
Okay.
I get my first email address by this year. But the answer is Internet. I mean, Internet, actually, especially in my area, telecom and web and mobile development, everything is online.
Yeah.
You see what other companies are doing, and then you have a lot of knowledge on it. I should also thank our universities, because they don't have a lot of means to do what they are doing, but they are giving us a real good background and real good base of knowledge. Mm-hmm. After that, you have to build from that, and then it's your own interest.
Mm-hmm.
This is the answer I can give.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Miriam?
For me, I think that I was a lot of influenced by the experience of my father.
Yeah.
So living with an entrepreneur was too much influenced.
Right.
That's why I think from I was 16, I was like, I want my own company, I want my own business. So that's
and
why.
He was always fine with that.
Yeah, he's too much proud.
You're very fortunate.
Right. So I think we are actually... being in a country where I think it's not so much people know that, okay, here in Malaysia we have so much information on this technology, brings us to, you know, do some of our research more than what we should have. Because I think, back then when we want to do our inventions and all that, we want to tackle something that's very urgent and very huge in terms of the impact that it can bring to the medicine landscape later in the future. So we think, okay, we have to do a lot more. So I think despite being having lesser information, the drive and the motivation that we have actually makes us to achieve, I think, a little bit more than everyone are achieving at the moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Hassanul, you draw off local products, but mm-hmm. did you depend on online knowledge like Mustafa, or do you just meet people socially and it rose into this level?
We did a lot of market research by visiting many of districts in Bangladesh, like Bagerhat, Khulna, and Sirajganj, and so many other places. But definitely online was very helpful for us to collect all the data on the product and the technology itself. But I would like to thank my university for this opportunity, because unlike them, I am from business background, so I hold my bachelor and MBA from accounting. So basically this is one of the differences, and most of the faculty members back in my university have PhDs and masters from USA or Canadian universities. So I think they helped us a lot with their knowledge, their expertise in this side also. So it was really helpful. I mean, like, we were not totally dependent on the online basis, because with our product, we had to involve with the people in
right.
the country. So we did a lot of that. We tried to do, and we're still doing it, to talk with people and get their views about the housing, about the cost, how to do it, deal with it, like, about reducing the cost more and making it more user-friendly.
Mm-hmm. And as you go to meet other entrepreneurs from other cultures, it seems in general you tend to find you're more like each other than your cultures are different. Is being an entrepreneur kind of an international experience? Is it a common trait to be a risk-taker, you think?
Miriam, give you the answer at the beginning. She said we are just all crazy.
Well, you're good crazy, though. I mean, you go down to the valley and you talk to the people at Google. Do you find they're like you also? Is there an entrepreneurial spirit? Well, that's a big company now, so maybe that's different. But if you meet other sort of younger entrepreneurs out here, do they seem like you? Do you see yourselves in them?
Yeah, we just get out from TechCrunch and Ustream. So we just feel like we have the same dream, for sure. You have the same dream for changing things. And then maybe the background is different, but we are sharing really the same feeling, the same... We want to change things, we want to do it differently, and this is our the basis of value which we've seen on them.
Mm-hmm.
From your perspective.
Yeah, we have the same feeling. This is the most important thing. We have the same feeling and the same challenges in our countries, because are from Middle East, North Africa, and Asia. So like you said, we are crazy for our parents, for our community. So to share this was very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, true indeed. When I refer to my colleagues, for example, as the doctors, okay, you're crazy, you're becoming entrepreneurs. And then when I join them in the GIST, then, okay, I find crazy friends like me.
Yeah.
So I'm happy now.
You'll probably do deals together before this is all over,
happy,
right?
Yeah, at least I feel back at home.
Right. And are there things you learn from business lessons you learn from coming to the U.S. and meeting entrepreneurs here, being exposed to our culture of business? Are there things so far you've noticed about it?
Okay. I think, yeah, a lot, because, I mean, venture capitalist is not a commonly used term back in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we don't have any kind of venture capitalist in Bangladesh. So it was a new term for me, at least. Like, we have read it in the books, but in reality, what the venture capitalists do, we really didn't know. But coming to USA and meeting the venture capitalists in person, I mean, it was a great experience. And now I know that what they do.
So, and in terms of, just to carry on with this, in terms of important thing that I keep from this journey, is there something that we are not very used to, is the right to fail.
Right.
I mean, the right to fail, and the when we met people and they say that, okay, this is our fourth company, or it is the seventh one. I just say how it is possible.
Yeah.
I mean, to
who
make it money five times,
five?
And then they give you money to do
right.
it.
Right.
So that just gives us a bit of hope, mm-hmm. and it's very interesting to know that you have the right to fail and start again.
So, do you feel like that's a business lesson that wouldn't apply in your country? You really have to make this one work.
Absolutely.
So, when you succeed, are you going to become a venture capitalist in Senegal?
Why not? I hope that we'll be coming here 10 years after telling you how we succeed in there.
And that's an interesting question. You know, yeah. Are there things you've learned that you'd like to tell people here? Mm-hmm. Because this, you know, good conversations go two ways. Are there things you've learned in your experience working in pretty tough environments with...
Yeah.
You know, a range of different markets that you think your American counterparts could learn.
Okay, so I think they are lucky. I mean, the first thing is that to know what you have in your hands in terms of doing something. American entrepreneurs have the opportunity of having an ecosystem that helps them to build something. They should not ignore it, and they should really take care of it. Because once this ecosystem is not in or is broken, it's very difficult to get out of all this.
Right.
And this is what nearly happened to our countries.
What do you think happened in your country that broke it down?
People have money. I mean, there's not a lack of money that don't develop the entrepreneurship. It's just because they are not used to give their money and to take the risk mm-hmm. of having this succeed or not. All that we're doing is when you have $1 right now, you put it that you want to have it $2 tomorrow. No way that you give it for 1 year or 6 months having the risk to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a different approach in terms of investment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, are there things you'd want to tell American entrepreneurs?
They are lucky to have this ecosystem.
Yeah, yeah, you're nodding vigorously, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just about that. I mean, like, it's an eye-opener, especially for this visit for us, to actually see how lucky all the entrepreneurs, especially the startup and the youngsters, newbies and all that, to actually have the opportunity to be in an ecosystem where the full support is there. It's just amazing. I wish we have that full support back then in Malaysia, yeah, as well.
I think it's all about like addressing a problem or finding a need and trying to solve it in so many different ways. Like maybe one of the ways you'll find that will click actually to solve that problem. So, I mean, it's all about finding the need and the problems in the people, in the society and all over the world. I mean,
yeah, we never run out of problems.
And also, I'd like to say something to the American entrepreneurs, like don't... just be national, go global.
Yeah. Say more about that.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about the entrepreneurs and the venture capitalists, like they focus on American businesses.
Yeah.
So they try to invest a lot in the American businesses, and which are basically like settled in USA.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they should not be only focusing on the US base, but also look for the opportunities the outside the USA.
This internet works in two directions.
Yeah.
Totally.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we really do agree with this, because the market is not in the United States. You have new emerging market. Mm-hmm. You're talking about Asia, but we're talking about Africa also. They really don't know a lot about what's happening there. And mm-hmm. it's not because it's a part of country that they don't have market. They have big companies succeeding in there, doing billions of dollars, but it's just the ecosystem is different. Mm-hmm. So venture capitalists should come there and start learning, because maybe it's the market of the future.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Margolis, as you hear this and as you think about this, how is this explosion of information, entrepreneurship, and this kind of shared culture of risk-taking that seems to be bubbling up in a younger generation, empowered by technological innovation in their home markets, what kind of opportunities and challenges does that present for U.S. diplomacy?
So I think you all now got a section of some of the fascinating things that you can learn from this sort of experience, but also exactly as Quinn's saying, some of the challenges that are out there. When I hear this, I think, oh, here's a whole series of policy challenges that the U.S. government could be engaging with other countries, whether it's exploring bankruptcy laws together or making sure that there's intellectual property rights protection, all things that would work for both our markets as young entrepreneurs try to create their products. But there's a second aspect that I hear, and it's the incredibly complex society that we have here in the United States and what Secretary Clinton likes to call smart power, which is that it's not only when you're talking to other countries when you're trying to achieve a foreign policy objective the role of government to do that, but that there are all kinds of non-governmental institutions, whether it's our university system, whether it's our NGOs, whether it's our venture capital financing structure, whether it's our businesses, and perhaps the most important thing that you've heard every one of the entrepreneurs talk about today, whether it's some aspect of a personality or a personal culture that an individual can bring to bear. And part of the job now of the State Department, the U.S. government, is to find ways to work in partnership with all of those organizations so that we can achieve our foreign policy objectives, not just as a government, but as a whole society.
And Kathy, talk a little bit about where GIST will go in the future. Do you seek to grow this to more than 17 individuals? Do you want to target it? Where do you think this can become in the future?
I think there's tremendous potential for a program like this. We are just beginning to scratch the surface of the potential that exists in terms of countries and entrepreneurs in those countries. So we will be continuing the program and doing additional competitions and startup boot camps and reaching out to more and more entrepreneurs while we continue to work with those that we have here and have identified over the last year. And we hope that and are committed to try to keep growing this program.
Mm-hmm. Now, Hassanul, you said you'd taken this out into various regions and sold it into a local market so far. We had a question from the audience that, have you built full houses so regular people give you feedback on what these houses are like?
Yes, basically we have done our test marketing phase and we have built 17 complete houses in Sawar Upazila in Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm.
So the customer feedback so far has been very good. I mean, they're very satisfied with the product and with the features of this product, like it's strong and it's soundproof. And one of the most important features of this product is that it is rust-proof, because Bangladesh have a very big problem of this salinity in the coastal areas,
yes,
because the house gets rusted in there, but our product do not catch rust.
This is a generally low-lying country,
yes,
on the Indian Ocean that,
right,
gets a lot of cyclones. So strong housing that resists rust is
a
fairly valuable thing to come along with. Now, I wanted to leverage off that question and ask down the line, what does taking your product out in the world teach you about what your business might be as you start to encounter the market? Does it change? And really, describe where you hope your company will be in 5 years or 10 years.
5 years down the line, I think we'll be still serving the Bangladeshi market because it's huge. But I think if we can serve the Bangladeshi market properly, there is a great, great market outside of it, because countries like India or Kenya and so many other third world countries have the same problem of shelterlessness. So I think 5 years down the line, I still see green innovation technologies in Bangladesh. But if we do good, so I think after that, maybe outside the country. Let's see.
Right, okay. As for me, 5 years from now, I would like to see my company to actually succeed exploring the potential of the market, at least in Southeast Asia region, and including our company, our country, Malaysia, and also to build up some collaborative effort with maybe US and also Europe and also Middle East, and to explore more with our new pipelines. For example, now we have artificial skin. Down the line, we're going to have artificial cornea, artificial liver, heart cells, and bone and cartilage, and a lot more. So we hope to be one day to actually be a hub to that supplies, actually like a factory that supplies human organs in the future. Yeah.
In 5 years, I hope to see my company getting like 13% of the local market, because we have a huge, huge market, and starting exporting our products to Europe, because for 5 years, we want to focus on this market. That's it.
Okay. So after 5 years, that we hope that we'll be in West Africa the leader of this new distribution channel of airtime, and then maybe after that interest all the African diaspora that are located in Europe and United States that to share credit with their family and friends at home. This is one of our targets.
Kathy, how do those visions compare with the kind of thing you used to hear from young entrepreneurs?
I think they're very consistent with the kind of vision and passion that we hear from entrepreneurs.
But
it's a good sign that entrepreneurs are thinking big and thinking globally.
Right. So. These really do transcend local
absolutely.
Markets for the most part. You talk about satisfying the Bangladesh market or the Algerian market, but then stepping beyond that as well to reach out. It's a kind of natural step now for business people of all sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a trend you see over at the State Department in your work in science and technology, Dr. Margolis?
Very much so. I mean, what's interesting is that internationally, if you talk to scientists around the world, they are incredibly conscious of the degree to which they are operating in a global environment nowadays, and that the talents, the researchers, the capabilities that are out there, it's a global network that exists. And in fact, one of the challenges that I think we face from a science diplomacy perspective is to help not so much U.S. scientists, because they know that as well.
Yeah.
But it's the rest of the community that maybe has a role in U.S. science, but not directly on the research end, to appreciate how much the global environment for science has changed. And so that even while we have first-class institutions, first-class minds, many of them here in Silicon Valley,
right.
Increasingly they have to be able to look internationally to maintain that leadership role. And that's just a different way of thinking about the United States' place in the role. Still leaders, but leaders that now have to engage internationally in order to maintain that leadership.
Well, let me get a little cosmic on you in that case, and maybe even above your pay grade. What do you think this kind of very, very powerful transnational sensibility and strengthening of alliances does to the typical nation state?
Yeah, so if you've done any work in the United Nations, one of the beauties of the United Nations, along with some of the flaws that it has, is that it brings many, many countries together, right? And the countries, as they're sitting on the floor, each has an equal voice. And what's fascinating to watch is that a country like ours, when we walk into the United Nations, we have clearly many things that we're trying to accomplish internationally. But what you see increasingly is that countries can understand that a small country, and this is a phrase you often hear now in the international community, can hit above its weight internationally.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have countries that may have small GDP, they may have a small population, but they can find particular niches, particular opportunities where they can be instrumental in a key issue now facing a global challenge and help to solve that challenge. And that just, I think that speaks very well for the, not to be too Pollyannish here, but the future that if we build those through the networks, the internet connectivity technologies, if countries start to appreciate the interconnectedness, I think this bodes well for the, again, as you said, above my pay grade, the future of mankind.
Future of man. I didn't want to go all the way to the future of mankind. I want to leave, we have just a minute left, and I want to leave one last big thought up to each of our panelists, not to put you on the spot, but this broadcast will go out to thousands of people, mostly in the U.S., but also around the world. Mustafa, I'll start with you. Is there a thought you'd like to leave us with?
Okay. So thank you all for once again for giving us this opportunity. If I have one word to say, is just be global. I mean, be global. Think about others. Think about other market and exchange reality. For me, it's important.
Okay. Here.
For me, I learned many things in these 3 days that I spent in California. But that's something I learned from Harris. Entrepreneurship is not courses; it's really spirit. And when this thing is burning in you, will never give up.
So I want to thank CRDF Global and GIST for this opportunity. So if ever this one opportunity, I would like to reach out to all the doctors and surgeons around the world. Let's build up together a new level of treatment for patients. Maybe next in the future, we go with tissue engineering. Thank you.
I think for the last 3 days, I have seen so many business ideas about technology, but to me, technology comes second, shelter, medicine, clothing come first. So I think we should really consider about doing these things first. Technology is very important, but really in the third world countries and all over the world, I mean, these problems should be solved first.
Well, thank you all for your ambition and your fearlessness. Those are fantastic thoughts. And thanks to our guests, this year's winners of the Global Innovation Through Science and Technology Competition. There are others in the audience. You've all done a fantastic job, and I want to congratulate you personally. I'd like to, in particular, thank and congratulate again the guests we've had on stage. Hansul Kadir Mizra, Director of Operations at Greenovation Technologies in Bangladesh. Khairul Idzwan Bahrain, the CEO of MyDerm in Malaysia. Mustafa Khan, founder of Amarante in Senegal, North Africa. And Miriam Chiri, co-founder of Smelnot in Algeria, North Africa. And the sponsors from both CRDF, Kathy Campbell, President and CEO of the nonprofit that oversaw the competition, and from the U.S. Department of State, Dr. Jonathan Margolis, Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary for Science, Space, and Health. We also want to thank our audience here in the room and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Quentin Hardy from the New York Times, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.